I've been I'm Adam Oliver, I'm from the LSE. I'm a behavioural economist, really, so I'm not an expert on food policy by any means. But behavioural economics has been applied a little bit to food policy, so I think I know a little bit of the arguments about, you know, the application of this particular tool. So, Cameron, aren't you? Cameron asked me to talk a little bit about how behavioural economics is used and possible alternatives. And this is a huge topic, really. We have whole courses on this at the LSE. So I'm going to have to try to address this within 10 minutes. I'll try my best. So behavioural economics is quite an old discipline now. There's disagreements about the origins, but it's by any means several decades old. It's only in the last few years, really, that the findings of behavioural economics have started to be used to help inform policy. 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. On any kind of systematic level, anyway. And the dominant framework that's been put forward, various policy and philosophical frameworks have been put forward by some of the leading behavioural economists in the world, but the dominant one is known as libertarian paternalism. And that was put forward by Richard Taylor and Cass Sunstein in a famous book called Nudge. Have you heard of the Nudge book? It's like one of these popular science books, basically. And that really captured the attention, it seemed, of policymakers at the time that it was released. So what the essence of this approach is, so basically you've got framework libertarian paternalism, and policies formed by libertarian paternalism, they're called nudges, basically, right, in the literature. The idea is that human beings make thousands of decisions every day. You know, you go through your lives making all these sorts of decisions, and most of the time these decisions are okay. You know, you get through life quite nicely with them. But some of the times, your automatic decisions, your non-deliberative decisions, lead you to make choices that, on reflection, you'd rather not make. So the idea is that you have these heuristics, these rules of thumb that sometimes lead you to make poor decisions that you would think are poor if you really thought about them for yourselves. Right? So the essence is really, it's focused upon what's called internalities. It's trying to make people's decisions better for themselves. You're not trying to stop people from doing things that impose harms on others. You're trying to make people make better decisions for themselves. So what Thaler and Sunstein said in this book is that what we should do is we should try to think about the findings of behavioural economics. The findings of behavioural economics, essentially, these heuristics, these rules of thumb. We should think about those, and when we've got a knowledge of those, we'll be able to redesign people's environments, what they call the choice architecture, such that people's automatic choices will better align with their deliberative preferences. So if you're a smoker, your environment will be redesigned such that if you really wanted to stop smoking, this would help you to stop smoking. Right? Your automatic choices will be affected by this. So they're not saying that we should regulate against particular behaviours or ban particular behaviours. What they're saying is that we should be trying to motivate people to change their behaviour. But if people want to carry on their pre-existing behaviours, then they should be allowed to do so. Okay, so that's what I want to say about. So libertarian paternalism, these nudges, basically they're redesigning the environment according to the findings of behavioural economics. They involve no significant financial incentives. If they involve significant financial incentives, they're tools of standard economic theory, not tools of behavioural economics. They don't involve any regulations or bans, I've already mentioned that, so that's the libertarian aspect of libertarian paternalism. And they don't involve sort of over-information or persuasion campaigns. Right? So you're not trying to change people's minds about things, you're trying to redesign the environment such that you're using the ways that human beings innately process decisions so that they make different decisions. That's kind of the essence of the approach. Sounds a bit complicated, doesn't it? But basically, a classic nudge, you've probably heard of these, those of you that work in food policy at least. The classic nudges are that, you know, you change the position of things on canteen shelves. So rather than having the cheesecake directly at eye contact as you walk in, you have the fruit and vegetables there. Rather than having sweets and chocolates against cashier counters, you have apples and pears against cashier counters. Those types of things, right? So people can carry on buying the cheesecake if they want, but the immediacy of the apple rather than the cheesecake causes them, sometimes perhaps, to buy apples rather than cheesecake. Now, the immediacy is an important aspect of behavioural economics. This is related to something called present bias. Now, there's lots and lots of findings in behavioural economics. I'm just going to mention two of the main findings because I don't have much time, and I think these are two of the main ones that are important for policymaking. One is the present bias. Right? So what's been observed in behavioural economics is people put an enormous emphasis on the immediate moment, and very, very quickly and heavily discount all future moments, far more than is picked up usually in applications of standard economic theory. And you can think about that, and it's intuitively plausible, isn't it? People perhaps eat too much enjoyable but unhealthy food, smoke too much, don't save enough for their pensions, do things that are harmful for the environment, all because these actions are in the immediate moment. And if they really thought about it, in some instances, they might make different decisions, right? So, redesigning the choice architecture, putting the apples there rather than the cheesecake. Present bites, very important. It goes back to, I think, the Greek philosophers talked about the importance of present bites. The other one that I'll mention is called loss aversion. Now, in standard...
Can you say that again?
Loss aversion. In standard economic theory, it's assumed that the utility and the disutility that you attach to a particular amount of, say, money, for example, should be roughly the same in magnitude. So if you lost £10, or if you gained £10, the utility, disutility should be about the same magnitude. Now, what's been observed is that people put much greater weight upon losing a particular thing than they do on gaining that same thing. So if you went away from this seminar now, and you got home, and you're walking home, you found £10 in the street, you'd feel a sense of happiness and joy about finding that £10 in the street. So you'd attach a utility to that. Alternatively, you got home tonight and you found that you'd lost £10 from your wallet, you'd feel a sense of pain. In standard economic theory, the pain and the joy should be about the same size, but what's been observed is that the pain of losing a particular thing is much greater and the joy. This has been found and observed time and time again, about twice as much, in fact. People care about losses about twice as much as gains of the same magnitude. Now, this is potentially, I think, an important finding of policy, because if you can get people to think about reference points, a status quo position, you manipulate what people's reference points is. Negative movements against the reference point are known as losses, and positive movements are gains. So, I'll talk about how that may be used in food policy in a moment. I've got a couple more words perhaps, haven't I? Now, this whole approach of libertarian paternalism has been quite heavily criticised. In fact, I'm a critic of it, but I'll try not to be too critical today. I'll try to give you a balanced view and then you can make your own opinion. It's been criticised for at least two main reasons. The first reason is that it focuses upon the demand side. It focuses on consumers and citizens and tries to change their behaviours, right? Such that they try to do things that, on reflection, they might think are better for themselves. And therefore, it does rely, because it's using these behavioural economic findings, because it's changing the choice architecture such that people's automatic choices will be different. It's kind of a covert tactic, really. So you're sort of manipulating the demand side. Right, and some of us are a little bit concerned about giving public authorities, public policy makers, further legitimacy for introducing covert actions, really. We'd rather, I think, policymakers be overt in their actions so that we can deliberate widely and openly about what they're doing. So that's one potential criticism. Another possible criticism is that they just might be not sufficiently effective to address some of the most profound problems in society, obesity being one of them, of course, right? So manipulating the demand side may not solve, by changing your cheesecake and all that sort of thing on your canteen shelves, might not solve the obesity problem, right? Now, behavioural economics over the last few years, in the popular imagination and in the policy community, it's been intimately entwined with libertarian paternalism, this approach that I've just talked about a moment ago. If you think about it, behavioural economics, really, it's just the science of studying how people make their decisions, and that can be used for any sort of policy programme, really, any sort of policy framework. And you can use it to help inform regulation, right? So, the biggest experts on using behavioural economics, really, to try to manipulate the demand side are private sector interests. Right? They've been experts on this for generations. So if policymakers have better knowledge of behavioural economics, perhaps they'd be able to observe when private sector interests are using essentially using behavioural economics to get people to buy more of things than they really want, or in some time cases, more things than is actually really good for them. Right? So you had a knowledge, you could have a knowledge of behavioural economics to lead you to an open regulation of potential supply-side harms. It's much more of an explicit approach, I think, and probably, I would speculate, possibly more effective in trying to manipulate the demand side. So an example in the food policy. Often talked about as a nudge, technically it's not a nudge, it's more of a behavioural regulation. So you could mandate, for example, and you'll know whether these are, you'll have a better knowledge of whether these are more effective than current practices than I do. You can mandate food manufacturers to place very simple, clear labelling on their food products. Say the traffic light system. Simple labelling of red, amber, green, depending on the caloric content of the food products, right? Now, going back to loss aversion that I talked about, from the behavioural economic theory, you might speculate that if you had a very simple labelling that's mandatory on all food products, people might focus upon the amber signal as their reference point. Right? The greens would be great, the reds would be not so good. They'd be a loss. And people might be particularly motivated against those red signals, but I think that they have to be very simple, food labelling. Now, when I look at food labelling, it's tremendously complex, usually. It's too complex for people to process. So it has to be very, very simple labelling. So the message that I'm going to try to leave you with is that you'll see behavioural economics talked about extensively in the literature. In terms of its use in policy, it's very confused at the moment. Essentially, the nudge policy, which has captured the popular imagination and the imagination of policymakers, mainly, I think, probably because it's anti-regulatory, and you talked about that earlier, you know, the central policymakers don't like regulation. So they kind of like this approach and are sort of pushing it forward. And they're overemphasizing actually its effects. Take it from me, they are. So you could, but you don't have to use behavioural economics for that particular framework alone. You could use it for all sorts of other frameworks. And some of those frameworks may be more acceptable in being more explicit, and they actually could be more effective too. Is that okay?
Thank you very much.